late. And this after I took a car service so I wouldn't be. When I finally spot him, Henry's drenched. No coat, no umbrella. He stops at the corner, gives change to the woman in the trash bag poncho. My brother told me once that he missed drugs because they made the world stop calling to him. Fair enough, I said. We were at the supermarket. All around us, things tried to announce their true nature. But their radiance was faint, and fainter still, beneath the terrible music. I try to get him warmed up quickly. He looks good, I think, clear-eyed. The waitress flirts with him. People used to stop my mother on the street. What a waste, they'd say. Eyelashes like that, on a boy. So now we have extra bread. I eat three pieces while my brother tells me a story about his Narcotics Anonymous meeting. A woman stood up and started ranting about antidepressants. What upset her most was that people were not disposing of them properly. They tested worms in the city sewers and found they contained high concentrations of Paxil and Prozac. When birds ate these worms, they stayed closer to home, made more elaborate nests, but appeared unmotivated to mate. But were they happier? I asked him. Did they get more done in a given day? The window in our bedroom is open. You can see the moon if you lean out and crane your neck. The Greeks thought it was the only heavenly object similar to Earth. Plants and animals 15 times stronger than our own inhabited it. My son comes in to show me something. It looks like a pack of gum, but it's really a trick. When you try to take a piece, a metal spring snaps down on your finger. It hurts more than you think, he warns me. Ow. I tell him to look out the window. That's a waxing crescent, he says. He knows as much now about the moon as he ever will, I suspect. At his old school, they taught him a song to remember all its phases. Sometimes he'll sing it for us at supper, but only if we do not request it. The moon will be fine, I think. No one's worrying about the moon.
We've been listening to Jenny Offal read from her latest book, Weather. Taking this question of scale into the mechanics of writing itself, this book and Department of Speculation are both fragmentary, modular with standalone paragraphs with white space on either side. With regards to scale, Hannah Rosefield in The White Review asked you if you write big and then pare down. And you say that you never write big. So
if only.
So because you're not starting big and then paring down to these paragraphs, talk to us about what you do do.
The only part I write big is I take a lot of long, long notes. But when I'm writing the individual parts, it's more about listening for the rhythm of the sentences to be right. And so I want my sentences to not sort of be placeholder sentences or sentences that are just meant to get you from one place to the next. So often just trying to have them have both a surface meaning so that I sort of think of it sometimes like I want it to be like ice that you can skate across so that you can read. If you're interested in the story itself, you can skate along on that. But I also want it to, if you chose to reread it, reward that with other things going on beneath it. So I spend a lot of time with that. And then I spend a lot of time really very much on the question of scale and also on the question kind of tone, because it's like, I always get the name of this wrong, that Pixies documentary, Quiet, Quiet, Loud. Mm. I often feel like that's what I'm thinking. I feel, okay, this has this pitch, emotional pitch, and we've had a little bit of that, but the songs I really like have those quiet parts, and then suddenly it's, you know, it's really loud and aggressive. And so I try to think of scale too in terms of that, in terms of like emotional movement. Most often with this character, it's with a joke that she sort of undercuts things, and it's very deadpan usually. But other times it's with, she's in a very daily moment, but she's remembering something about, like, the Greeks. I remember coming across that fact and just thinking, because that's the way a lot of that ancient Greek philosophy is. It's fascinating in how precise it is about things where there's no way that anyone knows. But I loved the fact that it said that they were 15 times stronger. Mm. Not just stronger, but 15. Exactly that much. And the plants, too. And everyone, you know, the animals and the plants and everyone on the moon were just, you know, these, like, bruisers, big bruisers that if we went up there would take us down.
Yeah. Well, when you say you're spending a lot of time trying to get the sentences to sound right, it makes me think of something, or I make this possibly false assumption around learning about your story that, you know, you were stuck on your second novel that was going to be more traditionally told. Mm-hmm. And before you wrote Department of Speculation for years, you were working on another book. And then in order to reboot, when you abandoned your traditionally told novel, you wrote poetry for a year. So is that connected to this in some way, to this honing of a sensibility around how the sentences sound?
I think so. I mean, this is poetry that will never see the light of day, but I did it to sort of remember, almost to just get like a shot in the arm of language and what it can do. And actually two little bits of poetry from those years. There's one section that is a complete poem in Department, if I can find it. It's about ether. Yeah, this was actually one, the only thing that made it from those, that it was about a year period. And I have a friend who's a very good poet, and he said, okay, that's a great idea, you should write those. And I said, should I send them to you? And he said, send them to me, I'm not going to open them for a year.
Wow.
And that was great. And that was so useful. Can I read that?
Yeah. Like, okay, so this is a poem.
This was one of the poems I wrote in the years. I put it, this is the only one that made it in. It's the beginning of chapter 39. Once ether was everywhere, the crook of an arm, say, also the heavens. It slowed the movement of the stars, told the left hand where the right hand went. Then it was gone, like hysteria, like the hollow earth. The news came over the radio. There's only air now. Abandon your experiments. So, that's something that happens after the narrator of that novel discovers that her husband is having an affair. And I've always been fascinated with ether and the idea whenever there's some kind of, I love to read sort of old science books, and the idea was something that everyone believes, including like the best minds of the day. And they're just all set, like, well, whatever else is not true, like, we know that there's ether that holds everything together. Now we have dark matter, right, that we don't understand that holds things together. Once I got really drunk with some friends and we started talking about dark matter, this many years ago, and I was like, oh my God, I know a physicist. Like we could call him. And call him. And so we called up this guy I knew who works at the SLAC, the Stanford Linear Accelerator. And it was very charming because he's a scientist. So he was, instead of being like, why are you calling me? He just happily wanted to talk about dark matter. But I'm always wishing I had more people I could get on the phone when I have these questions. And here, instead, I tend to dive sort of deep into the old books and research of it.
Hmm. Well, even though you don't pare down large volumes of prose to these taught paragraphs, you do aspire to what you've called a pared-down language. Mm. And you've talked about Italo Calvino's idea of the subtraction of weight. Mm-hmm. And I was hoping maybe you'd share that concept and what subtraction of weight means to you with regards to writing.
When I first came across that phrase, it was just one of those moments of recognition where you think, oh, yes, that I couldn't have said it that well, but that's what I think. And for me, the weight is not, it's about seeing how to make something more elemental or essential. And also for me, it's kind of about being brave as a writer and not assuming that I have to put... It's funny because I always do sort of know everything that would be in the white spaces. But I like the idea in a lot of the novels I like to read. I like the idea that there's a moment where the reader has space to think. One of the reasons I don't like a lot of covers for fiction novels is they're too representative. I would rather like not in any way imagine what a character looks like, or I'd like that to just be something that floats up when you're reading. I think that I both, as the novel goes on, I have more and more ideas that have to do with character and more ideas that have to do with how things go together. But I'm still just fundamentally pretty interested in the sentence. I mean, you know, I loved reading, that's what I just bought to read, the complete stories of Gary Lutz, you know. I love to read that kind of thing. And one of the reasons I didn't keep writing poetry is that I realized, you know, it's taken me this many years of writing to have even a partial understanding of what a sentence can do. And I don't understand what a line can do at all. So it's really fun to do that, but I'm probably going to save that for when I have, you know, 20 years to work on it.
Yeah. Well, for my last guest, Lance Olson, I was doing research for that conversation, and I picked up a book called Collage in 21st Century Literature and English, Art in Crisis, which has a chapter on him. But I was also happy to discover that there was also a chapter on you that was comparing, or you shared a chapter, Department of Speculation and Maggie Nelson's Bluettes were discussed together.
This is the Polish academic. Yeah, he just sent me this book.
Oh, he did. Well, with Lance, we talked about, for him, the political implications of the form of collage, because his book takes place in Weimar Republic, Germany, and that's when collage was put to political ends by the Dadaists, and there's also the implications of it being egalitarian and anti-hierarchical in nature. But I wondered for you if using collage, using associative movements as well as narrative movements between these standalone paragraphs, if it had any philosophical or aesthetic underpinnings, if it's meant to mirror something the way it's mirroring something for him.
Yes, absolutely. It's first, I share the idea that it is, that there's something interesting in it being egalitarian, that by creating paragraphs that you know, don't have indentations and that look more or less the same as other paragraphs with the white space around them, I think it's interesting not to tip off to the reader, oh, this is a very important moment versus this moment. Because I, with Department, it was about, I had a sort of little, not quite a generative device, but like a little constraint that I made for myself at one point to try to get the weaving of things back and forth to work, which was, I wanted whenever she's somewhere domestic and doing a clearly domestic task, that's when the philosophical would come in. And that whenever she was completely just in that realm of ideas, that an actual sort of moment of domesticity would occur. And it was useful. I mean, I ended up not making it that schematic in the end, but it was a useful way to shift scale. And I think that the other reason I'm just always been interested in this idea, I mean, I grew up with my parents kind of, at first, kind of lackadaisical Episcopalians, but then also going through a phase where they became very, very involved in churches that were much more sort of, like we'd have to go to church for like hours and hours and hours. And now they've kind of come out on the other side in the middle. And, but what I remember about all those years in church is just, I really liked the parts that were the teachings actually of Jesus, because they're so, they are always reversing things. They're always saying the meek will inherit the earth, or, and so I'm interested in every mystic tradition when they flip and they say this thing that you think is important is trivial, or this thing that you think is mundane is sublime. And I'm always looking, trying to figure out where that is. And this form feels like it allows the reader to participate in that mystic underpinning.
And you have this ritual that you've done long term called Library Roulette. And yeah. I wondered if that was in any way related to this collage process. So maybe share with us a little bit about what it is and
sure.
whether it is related.
It just means that I go to a library. It's often sort of a library at some school where they haven't taken the books out for many years, so that it has all sorts of range of things. And then the only criteria is really that I'm not allowed by myself to go into the fiction or poetry. So sort of I can't go into any of the areas that I already know a lot about what I'm looking at. And then I wander around really anything. And then I pick out books that look interesting to me and I flip through them and I see if anything catches my eye. They're often written in kind of dense academic prose, so it's interesting because when something does come out, it sort of shines in a way that I think is interesting. And when that happens, I write it down or I read the whole book, depending on how interesting it is to me at the moment. So I do that, and that's partly because I also use like oblique strategy cards, the Brian Eno cards. I do feel like it's very easy when you're working on a project for a lot of years to have your ideas kind of calcify, and anything that will kind of make me think about it differently is for at least 3/4 of the book something I'm trying to do. Mm. I'm trying to shake up my own ideas about what the book is in the hopes that it will become something better. Flannery O'Connor said that thing about, you know, if a writer is any good, they touch on something that is beyond themselves, that they don't necessarily even understand. And that's why it can be just as surprising for the writer as for the reader. And so, you know, I'm always, it is a sort of, it is like a mystical pursuit because I'm hoping for like a moment of revelation, however small.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to Jenny Offal about her latest book, Weather. When I was trying to think of possible meanings of the collage as a form, like if the form, as Lance Olson would say, has a philosophy, and I think about your last two books with all these fragments, I know that academic who wrote the chapter on you says that Department of Speculation had 46 chapters made of over 800 fragments. So apparently he might have counted them. But these fragments are jokes and scientific facts and proverbs and quotations, self-help advice. You could say they're juxtaposed alongside the story mm-hmm. of the character, but they also sort of are the story mm-hmm. at the same time. And one thing that came to mind for me was that it mimics living in the world of social media. Mm. But more I was thinking about how all three of your books are dealing with motherhood and wondering whether collage was a particularly good way to capture the fragmentary nature or the way that interruption and interjection gets then incorporated into one's own thought. At least the early days of being a parent.
I just did an event in San Francisco with my first editor, Ethan Nosowski, who did Last Things, and he brought that up. He said, "Do you remember? I remember when you switched to that, doing that style, and you said, I only have these little bits of time to write, and I'm just writing in these fragments. I don't know what's going to happen with it." And I'd kind of forgotten that it had been that circumstance-based. But I think it also allowed me to, I felt freer with that style. I felt like it was closer to the way I thought. I felt like it had its own dangers writing in that style, but I did feel sort of at home with it, even if it had come from, I used to write, before I had a child, I used to write kind of in these long stretches and then really not write at all, maybe collect things. And it was all about jobs and working various jobs and then eventually quitting a couple of these service jobs and like going away for a week or trying to just immerse myself for a while so that I could think again. But it was a very, each time I broke away from the book, I would think when I went back, I have no idea what this is anymore. It doesn't seem interesting to me. So it would take a while to kind of find my way back in. But yeah, I mean, I think that I'm always just interested in using a form that is useful to add to the emotional dimensions of the novel. So I didn't go into Department of Speculation thinking they're not going to have names at a certain point. But at a certain point, for exactly the reason you were saying before, where I was like, oh, such a cliche, these novels about affairs. And I thought about how when I'm in moments that feel cliche to me as a writer, that I do often sort of spin out above myself and narrate them. And so I realized, oh, okay, so that's actually how it's going to need to be there. And with Weather, I had this idea. I just really wanted to see if there was a way to make the prose kind of eddy and go. And I kept having, it's easier to make the gesture of what I wanted. But I sort of had an idea that also with one of the things with her brother, with the kind of anxiety and OCD he has, is that he sort of loops. He goes back around and around. Like at one point he's like, he gets this idea that he sold his soul to the devil when he was younger. And they have a very looping conversation about it where he keeps going, but what if I did? But what if I did? And so I was trying to have a form that would loop in the same way as the character's thoughts. And I also felt like often when we're coming into more knowledge about something, we learn and then we go back to the way we used to think and then we maybe go a little bit forward again.
Well, I wanted to bring up the term that you invented in Department of Speculation, which has entered the lexicon at large, art monster. Because I felt like the origin story of the art monster felt like one imagined bridge I had between your two books. So I was hoping maybe you could start, because this is a question not necessarily of motherhood, but of being a woman and being an artist, and what that looks like when one becomes a mother at the same time in our culture. So tell us about the Andy Goldsworthy moment. And sure. Then I just wanted to ask you, I just had some thoughts about your experience with that in connection with Weather.
Well, I'm going to have to go back and watch this documentary because I later found out that his wife was, after you get these ideas about things and then you find out more information, but I think his wife was an artist too. But I saw Rivers and Tides, and my household is big Andrew Goldsworthy fans, and so we'd seen books and various things of his land-based art. But what struck me in this movie was that he was sitting very calmly talking about the philosophy behind the art he did, and in the background his children would dart in and out, and you would see his wife sometimes sort of usher one of them away. And the part where none of it even seemed to register to him, because he was talking about the art that meant the most to him. And I sort of paired that with that idea of being impervious to the outside world. I paired that with like the stories that we also hear of, like, you know, William Faulkner and what he was like, or various people like that, and that concern I had, or wonder I had as a young writer, it's like, how relentless do you have to be able to become this thing? Like, how much do you have to cut out? How much do you have to not? How little of yourself do you have to give to other things? Is how I put it, and so. I mean, the art monster thing did take on a little bit of a life of its own. And then there became sort of debates about being an art monster, which I thought were strange, just because it's just a thought that she had about it. She wasn't proposing that one should or shouldn't be one. It was right. Most that she herself had ideas about this.
But it connects also, like, when you describe Goldsworthy as... he's centered in the frame, he's in the foreground, and he can be impervious partly because of his gender.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And in this society. And you were talking about how Lizzie is porous. So the very opposite of impervious. Mm-hmm. And it does feel like in a weird way, Weather is the reverse of that image.
Yeah.
Because we're not in the head of Goldsworthy. Mm-hmm. There are men in Weather, mm-hmm. and they're good guys. Mm-hmm. It's not like they're not mm-hmm. villainous, but mm-hmm. we're in the mind of Lizzie, the porous mm-hmm. Librarian, mm-hmm. Mother, and it feels like she is the one in the story who's not just mainly trying to grapple with the day-to-day. She's the main one who's grappling with the day-to-day, not just her own, but her brother's mm-hmm. fears. But she's also the main person who's grappling with this large-scale mm-hmm. issue. It's not that the others are mm-hmm. in more denial mm-hmm. around this than she is.
Mm-hmm. And it's no accident that her mentor, Sylvia, is childless and that she can sort of devotes her time to this completely and can do so in a sort of more pure way than Lizzie ends up feeling she can. I mean, I think you've hit on something. It did occur to me that in some ways Weather is like the character in Department if you just took the art monster part out and took out that sort of that kind of ambition that is has a very direct point that it's trying to get to. I think that in many ways this character is just very close to what I'm like. I mean, it's a surprise to me in some ways that I have such a... It's a surprise to me that I, because it takes a long time to write my books, I sometimes am amazed that I've stayed doing it. Because I don't think of myself as someone who's very disciplined or very... really even very habitual. But I did feel like there have been many points in my life where any part of thinking about making art was completely obliterated by immediate needs of people around me. And it actually did seem, for me, sort of inhuman to be like, I'm sorry, no, I have to go in my room and think some thoughts about 17th century science.
But you have mentioned that one of the first impulses of writing Weather was to create a survival manual for your daughter. Mm-hmm. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah. I mean, for a long time, I had the idea that it literally was going to contain a survival manual that you could even take out. I don't know how I imagined it, on the run with your go bag. And I worked on that so long, and it just was one of those things that I will often wrestle with a formal idea for a really long time to see, thinking that I just need to figure it out. But I finally realized that the reason I couldn't figure it out was that I no longer believed that that's exactly what the book should be. And so that's why it always felt like it was... Well, we go back to the idea of the subtraction of weight. It felt like it would capsize the sort of boat of the book whenever I put it in. So I ended up just as I got farther and farther into the novel, I used to, every once in a while, people, especially in LA, as it happens, people would ask me, oh, what's the book about? Tell us what it's about. And I always don't ever have a good answer for any of the books. They all sound terrible when I try to, but I thought for a little while, oh, I've got a good answer for this one. I'll say it's about a librarian who becomes a climate change doomer. But that started to feel complicated to me because she doesn't really end up a doomer. If anything, she ends up thinking that she has to find the others and join with them, and that part of this sort of silo of dread is part of the problem, where she's not... she can read and read and read about things being enmeshed or interconnected, but as long as she's still thinking of it as an individual, she doesn't really she doesn't go forward.
I would love to have you read another short section, if you don't mind, that has some of this climate advice or mm-hmm. or prepperism in it.
Sure. I've been hanging out too much at my old bar while everyone's away. It's fun to talk to people who don't know anything about me. And I spend a lot of time eavesdropping too. It's important to be on the alert for the decisive moment, says the man next to me, who is talking to his date. I agree. The only difference is that he is talking about 20th century photography, and I am talking about 21st century everything. Then one day, the guy I have a crush on comes in. His name is Will. Turns out he's some kind of journalist, recently back from Syria. He has an odd side gig, taking kids out for wilderness trips. No set line between lost and not lost, he tells me. And I write this down on a napkin. And then, somehow, it's four drinks later, and I'm telling him about the coming chaos. What are you afraid of? He asks me. And the answer, of course, is dentistry, humiliation, scarcity. Then he says, what are your most useful skills? People think I'm funny. I know how to tell a story in a brisk, winning way. I try not to go on too much about my discarded ambitions or how I hate hippies and the rich. But in terms of skills, he says. And I tell him, I know a few poems by heart. I recently learned how to make a long-burning candle out of a can of tuna, oil-packed, not water. I've learned how to recognize a black walnut tree and that you can live on the inner bark of a birch tree, if need be. I know it is important to carry chewing gum at all times for post-collapse morale, and also because it suppresses the appetite, and you can supposedly fish with it, but only if it is a bright color and has sugar. Only then will a fish investigate and somehow get hooked at the end of the fishing pole I've fashioned with a sharpened paperclip and a string and a stick. If you need to, you can use wet tobacco over a wound. Red ants can be eaten. They have a lemony taste. The Mormons ate lily bulbs, a famine food. Malcolm X and his mother would make soup out of dandelions when there wasn't enough to eat. If you don't have enough water, don't eat. Keep your mouth closed. Conserve your energy. You can last 3 hours without shelter, 3 days without water, 3 weeks without food, 3 months without hope. But don't drink your own urine. That's a myth. And don't eat snow. You have to melt it first. If you have a toothache, you can put crushed aspirin on it. All you need is to make toothpaste into baking soda, peppermint oil, and water. You can chew on a stick until it splinters into a toothbrush. He keeps touching my arm, this guy. Sometimes your heart runs away with someone, and all it takes is a bandana on a stick.